Welcome back, or welcome for the first time, to the High Tech Forum podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Don Nielsen, a man who played a seminal role in the development of the internet. Don is a retired vice president at SRI International, originally known as the Stanford Research Institute. As people who study internet history know, SRI played key roles in both the first ARPANET transmission with UCLA in 1969, as well as the very first internet transmission in 1976, which is our topic today. Thanks for joining us today, Don.
Pleasure to be here. Let's hope we have a good discussion.
Yeah, I'd asked Vint Cerf to do this, and he said that you're the man that I should be talking to because you played the critical role in this, in what we're going to talk about today.
Well, that's nice of Vint, so
yeah,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, so this I discovered, as I think a lot of people did, from reading a story in The Guardian on July 15th called How the Internet Was Invented, that described what can legitimately be called the very first transmission over the internet, which took place on the 27th of August in 1976. The anniversary of that would be Saturday. We're recording this on Friday, the 26th. And it involved a group of researchers from SRI, led by Don, who had a specially equipped van that SRI had built to demonstrate mobile networking at a time when mobile networking simply didn't exist. And so why don't you tell us where you did the demonstration and what you demonstrated and what it took to make that happen?
Okay. In 1976, we had developed in the beginning the developing of the transmission control protocol that had come out of Stanford and Vint Cerf. There were two or three authors of it, but anyway.
Yeah, it's what we call TCP.
TCP. Yeah. So in July of that year, we kind of got it crammed into a small microcomputer called an LSI-11. And anyway,
it's digital equipment's microelectronics-based implementation of the PDP-11.
That's right. So anyway, that took a little bit of doing. And of course, there were still bugs in the TCP, and so those had to be worked out. But we felt we had pretty much in hand. We had given demonstrations of packet radio earlier on an intranet basis, but we decided with this working, we would, and we had tested it lightly a little bit into, there was, I think, only two hosts on the ARPANET at that particular, the ARPANET being the wired network. And what we're talking about here, of course, is called the packet radio network. So these are among the first two dissimilar networks. At any rate, we had,
which was the point of the of TCP, was it was a protocol that had been developed for the express purpose of joining dissimilar networks to each other so that they could exchange information in a coherent way, right?
Exactly. And to do it transparently to the end users.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we had decided we'd like to make a little celebration of this, and wasn't with anything far in the in the future in mind. It was just, as you know, you go through a project and you struggle to make things work, and well, it works all of a sudden. And so we decided
First thing you want to do once it reaches that stage where it works is show somebody that it works, right?
Well, at least to ourselves.
Yeah.
And SRI was called the system integrator for the packet radio network, and even though there were other contractors involved, and one of our responsibilities as in that regard was to submit a weekly progress report to ARPA, and that was all done by email, and which itself wasn't all that old at the time. At any rate, so we decided, why don't we go someplace a little remote from SRI and send that same weekly report to the various players, but principally to ARPA, who was financing this. And the person at ARPA at that particular point was Bob Kahn, and one who had, among others, the foresight to try to develop a mobile digital radio network.
And so anyway, at this stage, Bob had secured the funding from ARPA for what he called the interneting project. So ARPANET was already up and running, and Bob wanted to take the next step and to join ARPANET to other types of networks.
Yeah, that's it. Although I think when Bob first had those inklings, he didn't necessarily dream of TCP, but he and Vint Cerf were the ones who actually brought it into existence. So that's fair. So anyway, we decided to go someplace remote and prove that this would work over dissimilar networks. So we went out to this little... It wasn't that we wanted to go to a beer garden necessarily, but it was an informal place where we could park this van. And by the way, the van was a piece of SRI Capital equipment, which had four racks in it or so and could hold a wide variety of experiments. It wasn't built specifically for packet radio. But I remember when we decided to have, we'd had panel trucks before, and I said, no, we're going to have something that people can stand up in. Mm-hmm. And so that led to the bread truck and to the ability downstream to host in that van, riding around in the Bay Area, generals and other things that, who came to see this thing work. But so the van had actually two packet radios in. One was a backup, but had a packet radio in it, and also the LSI 11 that held the TCP protocol, plus a terminal interface.
You had a couple of big antennas on top of it, too.
So actually, one small antenna, about 2 feet high.
Okay.
So this is L-band. This is around 1,800 megahertz. So the antennas are not too big. And even that was an array. So it wasn't a big antenna. But it was one hop away from SRI where the gateway was. And the gateway was, of course, an essential part of a TCP demonstration. That gateway was built by Jenny Strazazar of BBN back in Boston, who was one of the players in the packet radio network. And so we'd installed that in what was called the packet radio station. It was the dominant central node of that network. And so we sent this really lengthy, it was no short message or anything like this. It was a very long, drawn out message.
Oh yeah, there's a picture of that in the article you wrote for the Computer History Museum publication.
It rolls out like a paper.
Yeah, it's like eight feet of paper or so coming out of that.
Right,
yeah.
And that contained, of course, the input from the other participants in the Packet Radio project in order that we would integrate a report for that week's work to ARPA. So that's why Rosati was chosen, because we knew we could drive the van up next to it. We could be on a table outdoors. We didn't have to bother anybody, and we could have, you know, a little bit of internal celebration at the time. No balloons, no fireworks, no nothing. Just a bit of a celebration, both for ourselves, who were responsible for integrating it, plus the other players in the packet radio network and ARPA. Now, it turns out that ARPA really, a year later or so, tried to define for their own purposes a first network, inter-network transmission. And the reason that was done is because they had a packet satellite network they were also funding. And so in November of 1977, the three of them came together, and that gets more attention than this first one, which hasn't hit the press too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there were the two milestone dates then would be that you demonstrated a two-network internet, and then a year later, after North Atlantic Satellite Network, SatNet, came online, there was an additional demonstration of a three-network internet.
That's right. That's right, Richard. And that second one was at ARPA's request. So it, I will tell you, on the other hand, even though that had happened, it still didn't make big news. Even in other words, for us, it was just one more demonstration among many that we had to perform for visiting people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was some 20 years later that Vint Cerf was talking to an IEEE editor or reporter and saying, gee, you know, the first transmission occurred at SRI, and this reporter called me up and said, Vince says this, and I said, oh, really? And so I had to go back and dig in the SRI reports to find that particular November of 1977 demonstration. And that now has sort of become, I don't know, there's no official beginning of anything. And by the way, everyone should know that this is internet working with a small I and has only modest beginnings compared to what we call the capital I internet today.
Well, in my experience, when you're trying to demonstrate any sort of network feature, when you can do it with, when you have two networks that are joined together to form an internet work for the first time, that's a lot harder to do than to add the third one on.
I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, TCP had been designed to do multi-network, so I think the ARPA underwriting of that or causing it to happen was to show that the three separate networks, which they had essentially financed, could all now become together in a sensible way. Mm-hmm. And also, important, the addition of the satellite clearly showed that the internet as exercised that day could take place anywhere in the world. Whereas the wired ARPANET had limited reach, and obviously the packet radio network, first mobile digital network, also had limited reach. So now we could essentially take a mobile van any place, or mobile terminal any place in the world, and reach some expensive host back in the motherland.
Well, and to demonstrate this, you had to do, there were two major elements that had to be perfected or at least made operational. One of them is the radio system that your team invented, which used spread spectrum technology and was the first example of packet radio system. And the other thing was actually to ensure that TCP could, it was sufficiently well specified and well implemented that you could interconnect two networks.
That's both right on. Let me mention a little bit about the radio network itself, though, because we were fortunately given a little bit of license here, somewhat to anticipate the use of a military digital radio system, but also just to make it as, I'll say, advanced as we could at the time. The notion was that you could, you take a packet radio unit, and that involved a digital part and a radio frequency part, and it was about a cubic foot in size or roughly, but you could drop these out any place and they would self-organize. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted the protocols internal to intra-network protocols and packet radio network to be able to self-organize and do distributed routing, even though there wasn't a central control node. And as you know, I'm sure, that's a pretty inefficient way to move information. So we had a station involved, and we had a protocol that started to smell a little bit like, well, in fact, it was an end-to-end reliable protocol within the network itself, mm-hmm. but with directed routing now, and each particular node would transmit periodically packets to indicate, you know, what its connectivity was and whatever. So the thing...
So was there something like, in the first iteration, it sounds like a self-organizing mesh network, which I think would be something that would be really useful to have, say, in battlefield conditions.
And of course. And that was exactly the motivation and the consequence. We I think, did that quite well. The other thing is, since we had some of these we call them repeaters or terminal PRUs, whatever, but some were on mountaintops. And so we also did remote debugging. We could download, new software into any remote radio unit. And that, of course, required that reliable end-to-end protocol inside the network itself. All this was layered, by the way. I think we learned a little bit from the ARPANET at that time of the advantages of layering. And so what happened when TCP came along, it just naturally fit on as a layer on top of the protocol stack that we had at that particular time. But inside of the radio network, there were hop-by-hop acknowledgments and things like this that would help make the network more efficient and reliable. The radios themselves, I don't know, you want to mention a little bit about those, since this is a somewhat technical audience, I guess, that they were spread spectrum. And so I was a little bit about the radio itself. These were made by Collins, and they had Collins Radio in Dallas, and they had an upper unit, which was radio frequency, synthesizers, and you know, all the modulation products. And then there was a second section downstairs, which was all digital. It was a processor-based digital unit that would perform the internal routing requirements, the detection of a packet and things like this that were transmitted.
So did the notion of spread spectrum, where did that come from?
Well, we looked originally, because we were essentially had a clean slate here. We looked at, you know, talk about multiple access. You have a radio unit, a radio network, and every node is a broadcast node, omnidirectional and broadcast. So you had to worry about multiple access and efficient channel utilization. And so we looked at, not very long, but at frequency multiplexing and time division multiplexing. And what was pretty clear to us is that code division multiplexing had some advantages in terms of access and channel sharing. And that, and also we wanted to do spread spectrum in order that you could, and we thought in the beginning you could do a channel multipath resolution, things like this. With a broad spectrum, you can maybe lock on to peak detectors on individual multipath components or match filtered or whatever. Well, so we got
Weren't there some advantages in terms of interference, avoiding interference with other services that weren't part of your network?
Well, sure. Any kind of spread spectrum system with any code worth it's, you know, long enough to be, well, discriminate against other more coherent signals, will make them noise-like, and the same with other users that with different codes than yours. And so the whole notion was, could I make this signal rise out of interference, either of coming from the network itself or incidental traffic? So we had, it wasn't...
Were there other services that were using, you were in the 1800 megahertz band?
No, one reason, it turned out there were some radars near that frequency band, and we had to do one test to make sure that we weren't interfering with air traffic control radars or something. But no, it was generally free to us. We didn't have to worry about fighting for spectrum. And we got that from a government allocation. ARPA got that for us.
Yeah, I think that's one of the bands that cellular systems use today, 1800.
That could be. I don't know. It had its problems because, as you know, at that frequency, it's strictly line of sight, and so you get in trees or a forest or something like that, and you have to raise this silly little 2-foot antenna up where it can have line of sight connectivity, and that represented some problems, but. We didn't have any lower frequency channels available to us with that kind of bandwidth. So anyway, we kind of.
So did you have a license for that, or was this?
No, it's a government. We were in a government. Band.
Yeah.
So anyway, it had only about a 20 megahertz spread spectrum. It was the chip rate and chips per bit. Chips are the randomization is about 128 chips per bit or something, which gave us some 10 or 20 dB a discrimination. So it was good, and plus the fact that I think this, history has borne this out. Code division multiplex is a is really a good way to go when you've got
people would identify that as CDMA today.
Right, a lot of moving parts, a lot of people running around. And one thing we had to do on that radio, which I don't know, this is a little arcane, but it turns out it was at that frequency and at that 20 megahertz of bandwidth, we couldn't resolve all multipath components. And so if you're going to lock onto some peak or integrate some multipath resolving receiver, it turns out you would drop out, you'd lose the signal. So we had to do some integration across some of those multipath components in order to make it reliable. And we tested that all out. And so once we had done that, we could drive, for example, we could have a computer connection and drive from San Francisco to San Jose in the van and not lose connectivity at all. Oh, and I'd like to mention one thing that was kind of neat that thrilled us a bit. In order to test the system, what we had were character generators. And, of course, the terminal of that day was a data media, just a CRT. Mm-hmm. So we just repeated 1 through 0 through 9 and just kept sending that
over and over. So a barber pole pattern?
Yeah, it's just a pattern you could see on the CRT. And so we'd drive along, and, of course, the thing would stop, and then we'd start up again. I mean, it'd start up again after we went under an underpass or behind a building or something, and we never saw an error. What led to that was that in the packet, each packet had a preamble, which was useful for locking on to the, to synchronizing for the rest of the decoding.
The radio receivers and the signal processors.
And at the end, there was a 32-bit, what's called a cyclic redundancy check, just for error detection. And so our packet radio internal thing had reliable communication, just like TCP itself later did. Mm-hmm. So we would drive along, and you never see an error. With probably like 1 in 10 to the 12th or something like that. It was really very stable.
And so did you have a point-to-point ARQ in your so you must have developed a radio MAC protocol.
Yeah, inside there were exactly. And so if a packet didn't get received, then you would retransmit it At any rate, our notion was that computers couldn't stand errors. At that time,
it's a pretty profound statement. They can't. Yeah.
At that particular point, we hadn't anticipated voice. And that was one of the major reasons TCP got this partner called IP, Internet Protocol, was that voice didn't require that fidelity.
That particular kind of error recovery. And it had different parameters in terms of packet lifetime matters to voice, but it doesn't matter to data.
Yeah. So you got a lot.
And I think this is something that maybe the listeners are not generally going to be aware of. When TCP was initially implemented, it wasn't the case that there was TCP and also IP. It was all integrated into one protocol.
That's right.
And because of the requirements to do things like voice that have different time parameters than, say, email does, then TCP was split into two components, TCP and IP, and then UDP was added into that mix as sort of a loose interface to direct to IP for applications that wanted to do their own form of error recovery in a different way than, because they had different time requirements, basically. I mean, you don't receive a voice packet within 150 milliseconds, you don't really want to receive it at all because it doesn't have value for the call anymore.
It's well put, yes. So anyway, we would, and then sometimes we would have demonstrations. We would drive down so there wasn't an interruption in the signal, so we'd open up the top of the radio unit, the Collins radio unit, and pull out the synthesizer card. Of course, everything would stop. Mm. And then you push it back in and it would start again, and you wouldn't see an error at all. So
yeah.
That was
so
all.
When you're looking at the CRT, when you do that, the barber pole pattern just freezes,
exactly.
And then when you put it back in, it continues.
Right. And we
I'll put a picture on the website with a to show people what a barber pole looks like.
Yeah. So anyway, that was exciting to us and proof that we were on the right track to make a reliable digital mobile system. People in the beginning, I'm sure, weren't convinced necessarily that mobile digital radio was anything but an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
But with those,
it's completely impossible until you do it, and then it's like, oh yeah, of course. So everybody wants that.
Well, yeah, and of course, what's happened today in the cellular world is just so far advanced in the technology of things that we were just poking at the first edges of in 1976.
But you know, we still use the 1800 megahertz band. We still use channels that are sort of roughly 20 megahertz wide. We still use a form of CDMA. We still use spread spectrum.
Yeah.
And I mean, in both Wi-Fi, which I'm pretty familiar with, having worked on it in the very early days, 1990 or so, mm-hmm. and cellular, depend heavily on these technologies that your team identified as the crucial technologies and demonstrated the worthiness and utility of.
Well, you'd like to think you had some role in it, but you know, once the technology world gets a hold of something, they're pretty innovative themselves. And anyway, I don't know how much is attributable to this, but I think we're sort of pleased that the track that we were on was, you know, probably as good as you could have done that at that particular time, and consistent with what followed mm-hmm. later, if not.
Well, and certainly even if you didn't have a direct influence on everything that followed, the systems that followed your system reinvented, you know, the same things that you guys invented.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was essentially the radio network, what we were trying to accomplish at that time. We were trying to prove to ourselves and to ARPA that TCP was in fact a valid approach to internetworking, and again with a small I, but that was a pretty big deal. The November 22nd, 1977 demonstration. It was kind of funny setup. We were in the van in the Bay Area. We didn't have a celebration like we did in 1976, but the van was tooling around the Bay Area someplace, opened a connection to a computer in, this time it was USC, ISI, Information Science Institute at USC, and we did it by way of London. And the funny thing about it was that it went from the radio unit through a gateway at SRI across the ARPANET undersea cable to Europe. And there at University College London, I think, it went back, entered a satellite IMP, satellite router, back up through the satellite down to West Virginia and then back into the ARPANET again. So it looked as though the van, from a logical point of view, could have been in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't
mm-hmm.
make any difference, but we used.
So you went over the air to Menlo Park, and then from Menlo Park you went down to UCLA, and then through lease lines to New York, and then undersea to London, and then on over the satellite back to New York, then down to West Virginia.
Actually, let me correct it just a little bit. It was USC and not UCLA in this point. So we used the ARPANET to simulate the packet radio van being in Europe, mm-hmm. and we used the ARPANET undersea cable to do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was really ARPANET all the way over to Norway and to University College London on the ARPANET. So for all logical purposes, from a logical point of view, the van was sitting in London, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came back over the satellite link to Needham or West Virginia, and back there into the ARPANET to USC. So there was no real direct connection between SRI and USC other than the TCP, what TCP offered. So, you know, it was a 350-mile trip by way of Europe.
Yeah, it's sort of the mother of all dogleg routes.
I hadn't heard that before. I'll take that, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not necessarily the way you'd want things to work, but there are scenarios in, you know, failure scenarios in which you might have to do that.
Well, we didn't think about that so much, but we were trying to just do, I think, you remember ARPA was trying to be military relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've got mobile users someplace else in the world outside of the continental United States, this was a way to prove to them that this would all come together. And, you know,
well, I think that's not really all that different from the way the CENTCOM operates today. I mean, I think, don't they have facilities in the United States that they use to, in a sense, direct battlefield operations in the Middle East?
They sure do. They've certainly got a lot more power locally with them, for sure. But either from a coordination point of view or maybe remote computing point of view, that could be part of their system. I'm just not familiar with it today, but it certainly makes sense.
Yeah, it's quite an extensive network, and networking is certainly a very important part of modern warfare. Mm-hmm. But I get the fact that when you're doing projects for ARPA, and I've worked on ARPA projects before, even though what you're looking at developing is sort of a general purpose capability, it's useful to be able to frame that in terms of the benefits that the military can derive from that, from having that that functionality.
That's true. That's true. Not only to the military, but probably back to Congress as well.
Mm-hmm. And this was all government funded. I mean, this is not. There wasn't a commercial, you know, wireless networking industry that was just eager to build out product as soon as they could figure out how to build it. This was the kind of thing that was a long-term research project that nobody really appreciated the value of outside the networking community until it had been demonstrated and people could actually point to a tangible application.
That's true. I might also say that even the military didn't quite capture the need for it at the time. It took some there was a whole set of other players that were providing radio communications to the analog radio communications to the military, and they didn't hop on board this right away. It took a long time before, a very long time. In fact, I would say packet radio evaporated, you know, in front of the military services, because they had these other long-term obligations to another approach, a non-digital approach to communications. And, you know, sooner or later, of course, computers started to take over, and they were forced ultimately to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when, you know, what you demonstrated in that, what the van represents to me, it's like the first mobile device. So it's just like a humongously bigger version of the iPhone that came 20 years later.
Oh, that's true. It was the first mobile digital radio system, wireless system.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was half a rack of equipment rather than something you hold in your pocket. But principally, it was the same.
But in terms of capability and functionality, except for, you know, the engine and the wheels and the sort of vehicle characteristics of the van, the internals of it in terms of the electronics and the computation capability is not unlike what's in the modern smartphone. I mean, and fortunately for all of us, Moore's Law and advances in integrated circuit technology enabled the LSI 11 type capability to be shrunk down into a chip the size of your fingernail and the radio components to be similarly shrunk down. And this, you know, this happens because these are digital parts.
Right. It's kind of fun to think about how the cellular system started analog and eventually got closer and closer and closer to the digital world and the internet capability we could access as it existed in 1976 is kind of similar to the internet access that the phone really uses and depends on today.
Well, and these were parallel developments in a sense. I think the folks that developed the mobile phone started working on that project about the same time that ARPANET started. It's about 1969 is kind of the milestone date for the kickoff of both of those projects. The mobile phone work was obviously done by a completely different group of people at Bell Labs and Motorola.
But were they thinking digital at that time?
No, they were. Those are mostly analog systems.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Cellular, but it was analog for a long time. I don't know the date when they first started going digital, but it was quite a while into the development of cell phones.
The 2G GSM cell phones were the first ones to replace all the analog with digital technology where that can be done.
Yeah.
And that was, I don't know, well into the 80s.
Yeah. Well, or anyway, 90s. That's my story. I don't have much else to say about packet radio or TCP or those earliest days.
Well, one thing I want to wrap up on is how long did I know that PRNet was active around the San Francisco Bay for quite some time. When was the PRNet finally wound down?
What happened was, wish I had a date on this, but in the early 80s, let's see, packet radio went on for about a decade, from 1973 to 1983. Then something called the low-cost packet radio was built by Hazeltine Corporation, who was the one who won the bid and built something now that was about a half a cubic foot or maybe less in size. And they were supposed to be low cost. And so ARPA got a bunch of them to try to continue to build this more robust network. What would we do if, a stationless or no control node, whatever, were in existence? What were the protocols that would be appropriate for that? So for another 5 or 6 years, let's say, SRI and others had a contract with ARPA to continue with these low-cost packet radios, but putting them into the field now became sort of unnecessary because you were testing routing algorithms. And so they built big matrices of mesh networks in the lab themselves, where you might have 20 low-cost packet radios all networked together in a simulated outdoor environment.
Yeah, you can do a lot of that work in simulation.
And so that probably went on for another half a dozen years. So somewhere around towards the end of the 80s, packet radio completely disappeared.
Well, and that we were right at the dawn of the cellular industry at that point. There were cell phones. Cell phones were starting to become fairly commonplace, at least in applications that could justify the cost.
Right.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me about this very important milestone in the development of the internet. And it's really staggering to me how well you and your team were able to anticipate where the technology would go by, identifying the most promising candidate technologies and implementing them and demonstrating them to a broad audience.
I suppose if there's anything we're proud of is that we didn't just go the easiest way to demonstrate it. And, we tried to look to the future and we're quite proud of that. But of course we relied on, it wasn't just SRI, it was other contractors and ARPA itself. Without ARPA, who knows what would have happened? It's unpredictable, but they certainly had the foresight. I remember Bob Kahn, all of us at that particular point could see easily two things. One was electronic mail. It came into existence in 71, and that would be a sort of a ubiquitous capability in the world. The other one was digital libraries. I think we all could see how we could go cross-net in order to do certain capabilities or look up certain information. But it really didn't hit our minds of what has happened, and I think we just need to admit that up front, because we were engrossed in the technology of making something new happen. Mm-hmm. But the layers that came upon that, the World Wide Web and all that kind of stuff, you know, really define the network as it exists today.
Well, it certainly does for the end user, but it's, you know, you build a door and you don't really know what's going to come through the door.
Well put.
Yeah, and you built the door.
Right.
And without that, you know, we wouldn't live in this information-rich world that we live in today. So,
right. Okay.
I think you get the gold medal for innovation.
Okay. We'll take it.
All right. Well, thanks, folks. And when you hear this podcast, if you got it from iTunes, give us a recommendation if you'd like to. And if you got it from the blog, feel free to leave a comment. I'm going to post this podcast with a blog post that outlines some of the articles and shows some pictures of the things that we've been talking about to make this a bit more accessible. But yeah, bear in mind, August 27th, 1976, the birthday of the internet. And thanks again, Don.
You bet. Thanks, Richard.
We do High Tech Forum podcasts about every 2 weeks or so, so tune in next time for a conversation with Om Malik, the well-known Silicon Valley venture capitalist who founded the GigaOm Tech blog. Feel free to comment at hightechforum.org and leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.